Welcome to the Quest for Questions podcast, a place where up-and-coming entrepreneurs from around the world, just like you, learn how to navigate the ever-changing world of distorted reality. Today, we are joined by Nate Wright, my ex-mentor and maverick in the B2B marketing landscape and the founder of B2B Bandits, top 1% email and B2B sales agency that's been at the forefront of innovative email marketing strategies for almost 15 years. Nate's past two-year journey through the tumultuous world of sales and marketing has seen him navigate through the rise and fall of crypto, the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank, and the disruptive wave of AI technology. Despite the demise of more than 60% of marketing agencies in the US, his ability to adapt and pivot in the face of these cascading changes has allowed his and his team to stay in the game and live to fight another day or decade. In our conversation, we explore three key dimensions. First, the past. How the seismic shifts in the marketing space over the last 2 years have impacted Nate's approach and what lessons he's learned from adapting to these changes. Two, the present. Nate's insights into the current state of B2B marketing, the challenges of building genuine human connection in the digital age, and the strategies that are proving most effective today. And finally, the third dimension, the future, Nate's bold prediction for the coming years and how he's steering his business to not only survive, but thrive in an ever-evolving landscape. Join me, Conrad, your host, as we uncover the strategies and the mindsets that have allowed Nate Wright to remain formidable force in the B2B marketing. Whether you're a seasoned founder, marketer, or just starting out, this is a conversation you won't want to miss.
We are live.
No, we are not live. It's actually just a recording.
Where I wanted to start. So I think the last time we talked was maybe like a year ago. And podcast, I think we did like 2 years ago or something. It was the last time we talked.
Yep.
So I think what I wanted to mostly focus on is like three temporary dimensions. So one past, so like last 2 years, one present and one future. And starting from the past, what have you, for you, you know, in your world, in like US and also like marketing space, like what have been like the biggest changes that affected you, like both market or the world or, I don't know, the general cosmos? Oh, and what like have you done to like adapt to them, like personally and sometimes and also like as a team, right? What have you like on your side of the world, like what have been the biggest changes and how have you shifted? Like, what have you changed? How have you adapted?
That's a great question. It wasn't one specific change. It was cascading changes. So, and I remember the exact order, but crypto dying impacted a lot of things in my world. In my world, you know, it's, you know, sales and marketing agency, and I sell to every flipping industry under the sun, mainly focused on B2B. And I didn't think that would impact me at all because I didn't have any crypto clients. But what I didn't understand, and I do understand this now, is the volume of investor money that was in crypto. So in crypto, dumped, investors lost money, and the investors stopped investing in the people that are my clients, even if they're not crypto. So I had this knock-on effect. So that happened. Silicon Valley Bank was massive. I had clients that were banking with them that I don't know of anyone. None of my clients lost money. But if you can imagine having real example here, having $500,000 of revenue coming in via recurring payments. And all of them are ACH payments going into this Silicon Valley Bank account. So having to go and say, hey, we need this cash flow right now, and having to go to all of those clients and get them to update their payment information so that you could actually maintain cash flow. And as you can imagine, that's not going to be high on someone's priority list, one. And two, anytime you change payment info or change your platform, it gives people a reason to say, do I really need this anymore? So it was pretty devastating. That company recovered from it because they have a really good product that most of their clients needed. It was a need versus a want, but other folks weren't so lucky.
But why did they have to change the payment? I didn't get it.
Well, with Silicon Valley Bank away, where's the money going? Yeah, so if it's a bank-to-bank transfer, ACH, like that sort of, not like a Stripe transfer, but like an ACH, it's bank-to-bank. So when everyone has it all automated, now we're in a situation where there's no way for you to get their money because it would go into a place that doesn't exist anymore.
Hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. It'd just be failed payments. And
that's interesting. I haven't thought about business,
the importance of recurring revenue and a value of a business hinging on that reliable cash flow, right? Reliable cash flow. And when the bank disappeared, it at the end of the day, there's other banks that wanted those people's business, right? So like there are certain people that made out big when that up because they were number two or number three banks. Say, hey, come here. You come here. We're still in business. We're good. But that impacted a lot of things. And then the third thing, of course, AI happening, but they happened in sequence. It's like boom, boom, boom. And there are certain things I did correctly to pivot, and there are certain things I did incorrectly. I don't necessarily think that they were mistakes. We had to guess. No one knew what was going to happen, really. There's people that guess better than others, but it was still guesswork. And in certain times I guessed right, other times I guessed wrong.
So, yeah. So can you give some like maybe a couple of examples, like what were some of the right moves and some of the mistakes that you've done with pivoting?
So one of the good things I did with pivoting is we got out of the crypto space with our clients earlier. Like we saw the instability like a few months before crypto got dumped and FTX and all the other drama. So we're like, hey, this is kind of dodgy. And frankly, we didn't understand. And it's hard to sell or market something when you don't really understand what you're selling. So we got out of that space entirely. So we stopped taking those clients and really, really started shifting focus to more tangible businesses, people that were selling a tangible product, like manufacturing, construction supplies, things like that, because it at the time felt more stable. So that worked. And it forced us to get out of this automate everything, you know, automated and systematized and marketing, right? Drip campaigns and all of that. And we had to shift to folks that actually had salespeople and reseller networks and supply chains that needed to be, and then stuff was being shipped, physical products. Less e-commerce, more wholesale, which is a different kind of world too. So that was good because it gave us a chance to, it forced us to learn how business is done in that space, how money moves, both from a customer to a vendor or a supplier, and also how the investment money moves.
It was mostly B2B companies, right?
All B2B. Yep, all B2B. There's a few that are blended, folks that have an e-commerce arm and a B2B arm. And we like those because they're, to be honest with you, they're hard. But hard is fun sometimes. It's more interesting. So that's something that we did right. Something we did wrong is when AI got big, and AI has been around for a while, but when it became popular, I thought that's like, all right, this means that our unapologetically human vibe that we've got in our business, we should be good, because there's going to be a chunk of companies out there that like, you know what? Like, I don't want to spend $100 an hour or $200 an hour with a consultant if they're just going to use ChatGPT to create this content or create this message. I want a real guy. And like, I've tried this before and gotten burned. So what we thought was going to happen is there'd be a whole wave of people that would might try out AI or might have already and had been burned by it when campaigns going wrong, basically. That didn't happen. It happened a little bit, but
what didn't happen specifically?
What didn't happen is that people didn't feel like they were getting burned by AI. One, some of them felt like it was a good, and if like the messaging and automation, all the things that we're doing weren't great, those creepy pictures of three arms and all that, but people just thought it was cool. Even older people, older business people, folks that are more in more traditional businesses. I was expecting like all of the crypto nerds and all of the startup tech guys would be all over it. But like traditional businesses be like, you know, it's just a glittery new object that they could ignore. But they didn't ignore it. And my client started coming to me and was like, hey, we want to try out this AI thing. You help us try out this AI thing. When they started asking that, I hadn't even done my first prompt in ChatGPT yet. I was starting from zero. So in retrospect, what I should have done is actually played with the tools a bit, played with them until I broke them, so that I could actually guide those conversations better. Because the result is now I do use AI a little bit, but not how most marketers use it. So, but I was months behind. I lost clients. Not only did I stop winning clients because I wasn't able to talk intelligently about it, but I lost existing clients because they're like, you know, this thing looks cheaper. I'm going to try it out. And some of them tried it. And even though the quality of the results was lower, the cost was way lower. So in fact, maybe if I was in their shoes, I'd be like, yeah, it's a little messy, but it's cheaper.
So yeah, I mean, that's the, how do you say, the forever, not dilemma, but like kind of the difficult. I mean, Peter Drucker, I think we talked about it once in our, you know, previous conversations about the idea, like Peter Drucker wrote about the difference between a fad and a trend. And oftentimes, you know, like on the surface, they look the same. I think it is bad. It's something that people talk about, and a trend is something people actually do. So sometimes it's like difficult to tell the difference, like what is popular, but just people talk about it, like hype it up. And as you said, like it's for the nerds, and what is like some more long-term trend that will be, you know, kind of, you know, that more people will adopt, more businesses will like kind of adopt, you know, for themselves and embrace, maybe like the good word is embrace.
I don't necessarily think that companies should embrace AI.
Nope.
Unless, what? Outlier here, unless they're fundraising, having a little AI baked into something in your business when you're trying to get funding for your business or trying to sell your business helps. Like that glitter is really shiny and popular right now. But if you want to run an effective and efficient operation and from sales, marketing, ops, like running a good business, it's an expensive distraction.
Ooh.
Because, it's an expensive distraction. At the end of the day, it complements and fills gaps pretty well. I think it's a great super glue. It's a great glue for like tying things together and filling gaps, like putty almost. But it's still messy. And it is a bit unpredictable. And like at its core, it's becoming formulaic. even though it's supposed to be learning. And in certain areas, it is learning. Like I just read something recently about people are training up AIs in psychology to be able to deliver therapy via AI. And I think that's fantastic. That's a great use case for it because there's enough body of work that's untainted because it's academic body of work on how to be a good therapist and a question and answer. It's built for it. It's built for dialogue. But trying to run through a 15-step dialogue to create an image that doesn't have four arms and three eyes, that's not efficient. So I'm going to keep learning it and keep working on it. But you know, at the end of the day, my job with taking care of my team and my job with my clients is the same. My job is to, Charlie Munger, is to make less mistakes or help my clients make less mistakes and to actually get ahead. And to get ahead, we do have to make guesses. We have to gamble on where things are going. And the moment, I'm happy to share those with you. One of the things that we're doing is we are not just rebranding, not a rebrand, our B2B Bannets, but we are amputating anything agency related out of our messaging completely. So it's taking a while because we've been in business. It'll be 15 years in April, right? April 2024 will be a 15-year anniversary. Agencies right now are not what's needed to help businesses. I don't think so. Mm-mm. And that's not why. That's not a why?
Yeah. Because we are talking about digital marketing agencies, right? For context, for people listening, 15 years.
Digital marketing.
Like B2B. Yeah. Marketing, copywriting, kind of.
Well, there's a difference between an agent and an agency, right? So in the world of like investment banking or the world of real estate, say, right? You've got your brokers and underneath the brokers are agents whose job it is to leverage relationships and to buy and sell assets. In the case of real estate property, all right? That's the hierarchy. Now, agencies started out as advertising agencies where they were buying and selling ad space. So that they were an agent to get a broker of ad space. What ended up happening, though, is as digital marketing came on the forefront, there were no barriers to entry to buy and sell most advertising channels, and a lot of them aren't traditional advertising channels. They're communication channels, social channels. So that landscape changed, but the agency model, how they're structured and how they bill, that's the key thing, how they bill is not really designed for that. So what happens right now is that the company says, hey, I need to get more sales. I need more sales, right? I'm going to hire an agency to get me more sales for whatever I'm selling. Doesn't matter.
Okay.
That's wrong. So in two reasons. Reason number one is as an owner of a company, or someone that owns a product in a company, someone that has some level of ownership in a company, there are certain things you should not outsource. And anything that impacts your sales, you shouldn't outsource because it needs to be your asset. And not just, this is both from a longevity perspective. If you don't want to sell your company, you just want the company to survive, you need to keep those resources in-house because you need to have control. You need to have control over the sales and marketing. You need to have control over the product or services. You need to have control over the finances. That needs to stay in-house. Has to. Now, you could supplement with freelancers, but hiring an agency to just run that department for you, it looks good on paper. But having done this for 15 years and had tons of agencies as clients, it rarely works long term. You might get 2 or 3 months of good work out of it. You might get 9 months. You might even get a year or two, but eventually that relationship will die. And that company has left them in a position of weakness because now they have to go through the whole courtship process again to find another team to fill that gap. And you keep it in-house. You may have knowledge gaps in an agency, typically has more of a, what's the word, Conrad? The collective brain power of the team. The mind share, right? Like, no, that's not the right way.
Or like a mental, shared mental models.
Yeah, exactly, right? All those different perspectives. And they have experience with other businesses. So that makes it useful there. But that's why it needs to stay in-house, is that it creates a massive risk if that something happens to that relationship or something happens to that agency. And agencies are almost like restaurants. They're high churn. They go in and out of business all the time. There used to be 80,000 marketing agencies in the U.S. I think we're sitting at 20, 25,000 now.
Yeah, that they so many died.
Yeah, so that's the thing that what I want. The other scenario, this comes up a lot, is if you want to sell your business, when an investor says, do I want to buy this business or do I want to give this business $100,000 or $100 million, right? When they look at it, if a business is like a handful of people and everything is outsourced, right? If it's all outsourced, then the business doesn't really have any value. It's just a couple of brains. Maybe they own some relationships and they've got their sales and marketing outsourced. Maybe they have their production outsourced. So they don't really have anything. They have a couple people that orchestrate things, right? But they don't actually own anything. So the value of the company, they look to see, okay, are these freelancers you've got? That's risky. They're not employees. You don't have systems for training these people. They're not under your roof. So it dilutes the value of the business. And when you go to sell it, like if I wanted to sell my agency as an agency, one of the first things I would have to do is take some of my freelancers, go find enough work for them to bring them on full time and build systems for them that are replicable. Meaning that investor says, hey, if I put $10 million into this company, we could just add 3 more account managers or 3 more copywriters. So you already have it in there. You already have a system. You already have people. You have those human resources, right? So those are the two things. And in both scenarios, hiring an agency is not beneficial. Now, as I said, quick wins, agencies are good with. And the exception, and you taught me this, Conrad, is like, okay, well, what's the exception? All right. When is this not going to be right? There are certain types of advertising that you still need an agency for. Like one of my clients is an agency. They're in, they work with retail media networks. And I can't go to a major grocery chain and say, hey, I want to advertise my coffee on your network. There's no way for me to go direct to them. I have to go through a third party. That's their job is they do the creative and the strategy, the consulting and all that too. But they do act as an effective go-between in a very complex space and a very hard to reach space. Big mega corporate giants, billion-dollar companies. And that's something that I wouldn't know how to do. I imagine it might take me a year or two. I could maybe figure it out, but I don't want to figure that out. I'd rather just have someone do that and they take a slice. Right. So that's
so if you want to, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if it's like relationship something based, then they are useful. If there's like you want to enter something where it's mostly based on relationship, right? So yeah, as you said, the media. But actually, you know what raised me? So like two questions raised me when you're talking about it. One is like, how the hell agency model got so popular in the first place? Because it was like actually a new phenomenon. Like they existed like advertising, but they were like these big agencies, right? Like Don Draper, like Mad Men. And then suddenly, I don't know, probably like last 15, 10, and especially like I think 10, 5 years, like they exploded, as you said, like 80,000 in the US. Now it got cut, but like, you know, do you have some idea like what can explain this giant raise in the agency model? Because there's lots of models and lots of, you know, is it just the explosion of marketing in general and like agency was like the first, like the easiest model to kind of start something in marketing world, I guess, because you don't need overhead and that kind of stuff, like newbies like me.
I think it was driven by a couple of things. One of them is that boutique agencies, that's the phrase for it. The boutique agencies started growing. So what would happen is you'd have a big, an Edelman or some massive ad agency. You've got maybe someone in that's like a senior VP there, who specializes in putting ads on buses in cities, right? It's a very specialized thing. And they wrap cars now, and that's what they do. They do it for beverage brands, right? Well, if they get fired from that job, or if they quit that job and wanted to start their own boutique agency, they have that unfair competitive advantage of actually knowing that space. And maybe the beverage company comes to them and says, hey, do you know how to do email too? Do you know how to do SMS too? What about SEO? And of course, they're going to keep saying, yes, I could do that. Yes, I could do that. And they may hire a freelancer or hire someone to help fill that gap. So they just say yes, because that's how you retain them. And that's how I learned everything I know, is I just said, yeah, I could do that. I never said to what level, like, you know, yeah, I know a bit about that. I know a bit about that.
When I'm a fast learner. Maybe.
Yeah, I don't say that. It's not good salesmanship, actually. So that gets people more guarded, you know. Yes, I think that drove it. Also, people wanted to get out of corporate. They wanted to work from home. This is before COVID. They wanted to work from home. They wanted to work their own hours. They wanted to own a bigger slice of the pie. They wanted to control. That's an awesome thing about it. But again, the model itself, I don't think was ever built to support a traditional digital marketing agency, whether it's lead gen or SEO or a website or whatever.
So because we were talking about the past. I mean, one last thing, I know that also you, for context, you also, I don't know if you're still doing it, but I know in the past like year or so, you've switched to more events too, like working, organizing boot camps, events in person. So I don't know if this, because you didn't mention it as far as those big changes, but I'm curious if there are some like big lessons learned from that. But like switching to the present, because I was talking about the free temporal dimension, was like, because you just said that the agency model, like clients don't need it. You just outlined what are the problems of it. So I'm curious, like, what do they need? Like, what is the new model or new, I don't know, relationship with clients that makes more sense? Or like more
that I would say that, well, it's something we're still figuring out. But what we're actually doing right now is we're doing more done with you approaches, meaning that we'll take care of the nerdy stuff or the really complex stuff, like more complicated copywriting or campaign strategy. That's more, it's just trickier. It's stuff that's hard to teach. It's hard to teach writing. It's hard to teach strategy. It's hard to teach email deliverability. You're getting some of the basics, but you know, dealing with bigger problems or setting things up or fixing broken tech stacks, that's hard to do. And they don't necessarily, and business owners and businesses in general, I don't think need to learn that. And I don't even think they need to have that in-house because it's a one-time thing. Mm-hmm. Or maybe they bring in someone every year or two to do that. But at that point, it needs to be pushed back in-house. I mean, I had a call with somebody yesterday who was doing all right. They lost their biggest client. Happens to the best of us. They lost their big client. I need some marketing. They wanted to get all this stuff done and just do LinkedIn and email. But they're selling into an industrial space where you need the phone. You need to make calls. And I was like, hey, we could help you get your tech stack set up, tweak some of your messaging so you could get more conversations started. But if you want to make sales in the market in 2024, you need to pick up the phone too. And he didn't want to do it. So his choice was, all right, I could suck it up and do the uncomfortable thing. That's choice number one. And you know, choice number two is he could hire a salesperson. All right. That costs money though. And he honestly, I don't think he had the money to hire a salesperson. Or wasn't willing to spend the money to hire a salesperson. His other choice is to keep doing what everyone's doing right now and keep talking to agencies till he finds someone that says, yes, I could do it with just email and LinkedIn outreach. Yeah, of course I could do that. And they might even get him a couple of sales. It might work. And then it'll work and then it'll stop working. All right. And unless, of course, they are just absolute masters in that particular industry, right? There's always exceptions, but ultimately, it's that model is very broken, right? So what I think he should do is get some tech set up. Whether or not he hires us, it doesn't really matter. He does need a stronger foundation, better tools. Like if you open up an auto shop, right? Say you want to fix Honda motorcycles, right? That's the business that you have. If you have better tools, your repairs will go faster and you will make more money, right? If you've got better mechanics, you'll make more money. Now, if that mechanic is fractional or part-time, as soon as a good full-time job shows up, they're gone. So yeah, you've lost that talent. So there's that gap that needs to be filled. And that's the big issue that I see right now with businesses in general, including my own. I see this in my own business is that I'm trying to grow and scale and grow and scale and have everything put into growth. Ultimately, the real target needs to be how do I develop a strong enough business model with high enough margins, enough cash flow, the math works. So I can actually take this critical role to my business and have it full time and in house. And until I reach there, that needs to be me. Right. And you may need to hire part timers or freelancers or agencies to help fill that gap. But the end goal either needs to be you need to learn it as an owner, and that needs to become part of your role in your own company. Which is not, that has a whole different set of downsides. Or you need to do it long enough to bring in enough cash and cash flow to actually afford to bring somebody in to do that job and do it and stay with the business. And that aspect of loyalty, I've had freelancers with me off and on for years. The reason I can't say, hey, this guy's been with me for all 15 years is because I was trapped in that freelancer model. I didn't want to do payroll taxes. I don't want to offer benefits. It's too expensive, blah, blah, blah. But I ended up on the cycle of losing people and having to retrain folks. And I'd get a freelancer up to like 20 hours a week. Maybe we had a bad month and the model broke over and over and over and over and over again. And so as a business owner looking at, how do I get that longevity? That's what I've been obsessed about lately is not about how do I flip my business? How do I engineer my business to last 30 years? How do I engineer my business to be strong enough so if I had someone to hand it to, you know, a son or a daughter or a grandchild or a nephew, you know, if I actually wanted like succession style, like the show Succession, if I wanted to actually do that, would the company survive being handed off? Would the employees stay if I was gone? I'm thinking about a lot about that because one of the things is it was Warren Buffett talking about Coca-Cola, company Coca-Cola, talking about how old the company. He said, yeah, the company 118, 123 years old or something. He said, yeah, I love Coca-Cola as a company. And that just blows my mind. It's like, even if you don't hold on to your business, I think that the DNA of businesses that last that long just are stronger businesses. They don't have the hockey stick growth that investors like, but it has the growth that long-term thinkers and long-term investors and mainly long-term employees like. There's plenty of people that will take a pay cut in exchange for stability.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think this is like you collide these two, I would say, sides of the coin. Like one is the we've just been talking about the sort of failure of this, like, you know, approach that's been very popular for the past like 10, 15 or whatever, 20 years of this like tech companies, yeah. Like where basically the idea is to scale as fast as possible and sell the business. Like actually the goal is to sell it. It's not to like, mm-hmm. as you were saying with the other one, which is to like keep it as long as possible. So basically, you know, and the great thing is like you, like some people succeeded with it and it's like, great. But at the same time, the success ratio is super low. Like for, I think it's like, the problem I think with it is it's like it sounds very sexy, so like people cling to it, especially the young people, because like kind of get rich quick kind of vibe to it, like, hey, I will work 3 years and create this startups and just fucking never have to work again in my life. And you know, like the people you hear about and watch, they succeeded, but like you don't hear about all the people that fucking failed.
And Halo effect, right? It's the halo effect. One of those big monster biases.
Or survivorship bias too, where like you only see, like I learned this incredible, not learned, but like started incorporating this one great mental model, especially for consulting, but in general. Mm-hmm. Keith Cunningham also talked about it, is that usually like what, you know, bites you in the ass and it's the hardest to see is the thing that is missing. That like, for example, you start working with a client and is consulting him. You see all the things he may be doing wrong and he improved, but the hardest thing is to see what he's not doing. Like it's like, and what you are not doing and what you lack. It's like, so with that, it's like, you don't see all the failures. So I kind of think that, you know, that's better.
Yeah, no, it's difficult. Would in expertise-based businesses, so consulting, engineers, software people, guys like me, it's expertise-based, right? Like we make a living based on what we know and what we've learned, our experience and knowledge, right? It's what's stored up in our brain.
And ideas. Idea business.
Yeah. Yeah. Too, like being able to spin out a bunch of ideas and the, it's really difficult for me right now as, you know, a recovering email expert, and I'm still an email expert and I've done that for a long time. And we have all the little badges and things on our website to say we're awesome at it and people, we are awesome at it. However, who would I go to right now to guide me in my career? Who would I go to that can provide that external perspective? That's one of the best way to break out of bias is getting a disinterested third party or getting any third party to weigh in on it, because it's like, you know, to shake things up. Of course, there's a problems with you know, people fluffing up your ego or telling you what you want to hear, or people just not just being wrong with their advice. However, that is something that I need. And there aren't that many people in the email space that could advise me, because I made it to the top. Now, probably not in the top anymore. You know, in certain industries and certain sectors I am, but like top of the email food chain, I don't know. And I don't necessarily care about that anymore. And that was the hard thing, is that now that I'm here, instead of saying, how do I like build like a tower on top of the hill to make me, to get me up, that is way, way too near. I didn't know what, like you said, what I was not doing. And one of the things that I was not doing and that I'm doing now aggressively is writing. That is one of my unfair advantages in this space and marketing in general, is that I know how to write. And I know how to write for other people, and I know how to write for me. And I hadn't been writing for me at all. I hadn't been publishing. It was you that pushed me over the edge. It's like, let's publish this thing together. I could have done that myself 10 flipping years ago, and it would have been okay. Right? But now I'm a published author. Now you're a published author. Now we went and did it. Now I'm doing it again. And that's something that I wasn't doing, that I had the skills and the knowledge and the time for. And what ended up happening is I got distracted, and I ended up falling into those old habits of chasing clients and chasing margin and chasing upgrades and chase, instead of actually sitting down and building a body of work that could give me a stronger foundation that'll weather things. Like, books have been around for thousands of years. Digital marketing agencies have been around for 20. So if I want to think about longevity, maybe I need to be in a different business. So that's the big mind shift. You want to be like, if not an agency, what then? I think we'll still be consultants for sure. And we'll definitely be teachers and trainers for sure. And we definitely know how to do things to help people out for sure. But I don't want to run the Jiffy Lube of marketing, of email marketing or B2B marketing. What I want is to teach people to do it, to actually have the willingness to actually do that uncomfortable work. And it's less about skill and more about comfort. It's uncomfortable for me to write for myself. It's easy to influence other people. I'm like emotionally detached. And if it doesn't go well, sorry, let's try again next time.
Yeah.
But it's uncomfortable. I mean, you're living it right now, dude. How long have you been in South America? Three years?
A year and a half in Argentina, now past. Yeah, year and a half. A lot of uncomfortable moments.
Yeah, I know. A lot of drama too, man. But your willingness to do that and to actually shift out of like email copywriting as your main thing and moving into like being a podcast host and a strategist and trying all these different things out is scary as hell. Probably still scary, right? I mean, you're getting better at it. Rory Sutherland, come on. Right.
No, I'm now... it cut off. Can you repeat the last one? Let's just say.
No, I mean you were able to land Rory as a guest recently, Rory Sutherland, which is just like, it's a big feather in the cap, right?
Have you listened to it?
Yeah. It's that guy.
Was it any good?
I want to like set him up as just a bedtime thing, like. So, hey, like, here's like, I need him to give me good advice and record it, and I'll just be my ringtone and my little go to sleep app, my little sleep app on my phone, be all the things. He just has a great voice. Pisses me off. I wish my voice sounded like that. I wish I could steal his
fucking Brit. It's the British people. It's like everyone is jealous of
I don't know how many cigarettes he smoked back in the day. Maybe you need to start smoking a pack a day or something to get that gravel.
No, but actually coming back to on the serious note, I've been like for the past half a year, I've mostly been actually consulting. And I think I found like my kind of alley for now. I mean, for now it's like Ian, he was my friend, but I successfully pivoted him from kind of ebook because he's in the fitness industry, like has a huge YouTube channel. And I successfully, you were talking about like, what's the role of like, what's needed. It's like this guy really described it perfectly. Like consultant is like a jiggler. Like if you are stuck, you need someone to like give you a push, like a small push. Like you don't need someone to like teach you. Oftentimes you just need like to get out of the like a rigid mind frame or like some self limiting assumptions, kind of like this. So I kind of gave him a push and guided him, really just, I didn't know much just from books, on switching to subscription business model and kind of building a community. So pivoting from like having shitloads of people watch his videos, all that stuff, and maybe buy his ebooks, and just kind of like this, you were saying, like this kind of like, you know, sinusoid kind of income statement to this kind of income statement.
Slow and steady growth.
And most importantly, what Rory was talking about, so like the relationship thinking versus transactional thinking. I think that's like the biggest shift that is needed in many businesses. I feel like to think about, you know, instead of like the amount of people and all that glittery stuff, like how can I build and retain relationships? Mm-hmm. Because if you can, you know, for example, if you have even 100 people, he will have 1,000. Like if you can give him transformations, like they will just, you know, recommend him all over the place, and then he can build on top of it. You know, now they pay him, I don't know, $50. He can organize workshop. He can build, you know, he can build like on top of the base a lot of things, as long as he can like switch from this like one-off purchases, you know, mode.
You mentioned a community brings something to mind. That is one of the things that I'm working on right now. And it's, I don't think there are that many people out there that are good at it. Good at building a digital or even an in-person or a hybrid community. There aren't that many people that are good at it. And I've worked, one of my clients last year ran like a digital marketing community, and they crushed it. I mean, it wasn't massively, like, it wasn't like a multi-billion-dollar business, but it was a healthy business with a really healthy community that kept growing and was well moderated and how they had their systems set up. I was just wildly impressed. Geek Hub is a community, wildly impressed with it. And I'm still a paid member. There are certain Slack communities. I think startupcpg.com. It's probably one of the best moderated communities I've been in. And I'm not really in that space, but I'm just love watching how they do business. That's another really good one that I've been impressed with. And there was a guy, how to write useful books. He's
living in.
So. Yeah, his community is good. And he actually writes about community building. That's a book he's working on now. I don't know if it's published yet. And I really want to get my hands on that book because his mental models for how he thinks and makes decisions with his community are really smart. Really, really smart. And not just, again, not focused on hockey stick growth, but focused on health. Like if the healthy community is there, people will come in time if you have the systems in place. And we're trying to look at this huge growing population of business owners that aren't getting funding. They aren't able to get loans because freaking interest rates are crazy or their credit score sucks. they're not able to, they're missing skills. So how would we make a community to teach people like B2B marketing, right? That's what I do. And our first foray into it, we did a couple of test runs, like group boot camps, group workshops, like digital things. They didn't go that well, man. They didn't go that well. No. Well attended. I know how to get butts in seats, right? That's easy. But the quality of the engagement of the group and the engagement between events and between activities was crap. It was crap. It wasn't healthy. It was certainly not something I would want to keep doing. Even if it worked a little bit, I shouldn't keep doing it until I figure out a better model. Because again, to go back to the original point, one of the reasons that like Geek Hub, for example, I think does so well is they actually have full-time people hired to moderate.
Yeah, I think.
Yeah, they have it under their umbrella. Yeah. So I'm like, and I imagine there was times when the owners, you know, like had to cough up some of their own money to keep it going. And, you know, as they're starting up and building it up, but I have to think of it like, all right, if I build this and I'm charging for it, it's a paid community. One of the first goals needs to be bringing in enough cash flow that I get to say, hey, you're a professional community manager. I'm going to hire you full time to do this. And then do the things to instill the loyalty and the culture and all those other things to have that person stay. And if they do leave, are like Derek Sivers' style of leaving the company where he'll find the replacement, train him up. That's the dream, right? I don't know if you remember that story from Derek Sivers from when he, like, one of his first jobs. And when he left the job, he didn't know what you're supposed to do. He hadn't had a lot of jobs. And he actually found his replacement, trained his replacement, basically hired the replacement. And he went in to give his notice. You're like, you know, okay, fine. And he said, oh yeah, here's the replacement. This is his name. He's already been trained up. Like he handed it off. Like when he quit, he handed it off, like boxed out perfectly. Now Derek Sivers is a different level human being. I don't think it's fair to like try to, I've tried to be like him and have failed miserably because I think it's like superhuman level, like self-awareness and other awareness.
Yeah. True. Interesting.
Yeah, but that's the kind of stuff I've been obsessing with lately. So.
I have the last follow-up question. Do you have 5 minutes?
Yeah. No, I'm good.
No, I guess you hinted out because we talked about like the present. We just now touched a little bit on the future because that was like my last kind of question that I think you kind of touched on with the Yakuza. So about the idea of what are you thinking about? So like, how do you make like a sustainable long-term business that you can like even hand off to your children that survives all the like crashes and whatever, all the problems, catastrophes of the world. And then we talked about like, where are you going kind of with the business, about like the workshops, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I know because connected to that is my question basically was like, I wrote it down, like, what are some of your bold predictions for the coming years, or and how are you steering yourself and your business to like adapt to those changes, you know, or create some of the changes? But like, what do you think are
create some of the changes? That's a good footnote on the question. A bold prediction: I think this year is going to be harder than last year. For everybody, there's always going to be exceptions and people, I'm doing great in this shitty economy. It's not sustainable. Like how things are, especially I'm just my lane, right? My perspective is on the B2B world and then overlaid with marketing and sales and growth, right? That's my perspective. The amount of talent being thrown in out of their jobs into freelance marketplaces like Upwork and Fiverr. There's a lot of talent out there, and there's not enough work for that talent, partially because the work has gotten easier. It is easier to send cold emails. It is easier to build the website. It is easier to run ads. It's all easier. Now, when it gets easy, platforms get flooded. And what's happening right now is we've got this like perfect storm of excess talent, not enough work, not enough money. Oh, there's money, but the people with the money are sitting on their money. They should do. That's smart to sit on it. So I think, so that's the bold prediction, is that 2024 is going to be even harder than 2023. What I'm doing to prepare for it, I've already been doing. I leaned out a lot. Like, it's like we've got 2.5 people in the company right now. There's a couple of long-term freelancers that we pay. Yeah, shut up, man. Lean out and stay lean. That's the key thing, stay lean. We've pivoted to pivoting. We're not fully there yet, to a flat fee model so that we're not penalized for efficiency. We're pushing a lot more training, knowing that these clients aren't going to be with us forever. The goal is for them to actually graduate out. We want them to go out into the world and spread the word. But what I don't know is I don't know the level of willingness people will have to be that uncomfortable, to pick up the phone and sell, to show up and sell, to mail out a card. We're doing cards again. Yep. And it takes time. It takes a couple hours sitting down and writing out 50 addresses and putting your stamps on it, write a little thoughtful note on everything. It takes time. And I could certainly teach people, and my team and my community could teach people to weather 2024 and maybe even grow their businesses and improve their lives in 2024. Unfortunately, I don't think enough people have the willingness to, because the stakes aren't high enough, meaning that they're not hurting enough. It's not painful enough. It's not scary enough. And I think that 2024 will push people into that. We'll see quality of life go down. And granted, the quality of life for Americans right now is crazy. Like, even people that are living on welfare, some of them are doing okay. And I've been in poverty. I've been everything but homeless, right? I've hit rock bottom plenty of times in my life. But that level of pain forced me to say, okay, I could live in the mud puddle right now, or I could do hard things and maybe get deeper into the mud in order to actually figure this out and get out and stay out. And I've been able to stay out of the mud, thankfully. But I also have had to revisit things I didn't think I was going to have to do again. I didn't think I was going to have to do mailers again. I didn't think I was going to have to hustle so hard for a small project. I didn't think I was going to have to fire people last year, but that's what I had to do. And I didn't have to. I could have just let the business fail. I could have just gotten a regular job maybe, but that's what I had to do. So I think that's what I don't know. I'm curious to see is how bad it'll have to get for entrepreneurs, we say. How bad will it have to get before they actually do things that they were previously unwilling to do? They have the skill, they just don't have the will. And Was it Dalio talks about the great reset when it comes to the economy? I think that we're going to have a great reset when it comes to willpower, to grit, sisu. Right. So that's where I am right now. And ultimately, the stuff I'm doing, I'm going to continue doing. But one of the things that helps businesses survive a long time is being agile. And I just had a meeting just yesterday with my business partner, David. And I'm like, man, I wish that we had enough consistency in like the projects that are coming in and the clients that are coming in and the challenges that are coming in, so we could box this out and systematize it and automate some of it. And maybe like say our business looked like this, now it's going to look like this with these systems, and be able to like flow chart it out. But the fact is that it's so messy right now, we actually need to embrace the chaos and just have a set of rules, or as you would say, Connor, had principles, to have a set of principles that'll guide us through it. Pre-make the decisions that we're going to stay out of crypto, for example. You know, we're not going to sell digital courses, pre-made decision, right? But for the rest of it, I don't know. But we are very willing and have been willing and shown with our behaviors and our actions, willing to do things well outside our comfort zone to weather it enough so we can learn it, so we can teach other people how to weather it and maybe grow through it. We'll see though. We'll see.
Can I ask you why, because you multiple times in our conversation today, you talked about the picking up the phone or writing a postcard, something as something that are people like unwilling to do. I mean, we are talking in context of marketing. So why those things do you think is the case that for a long time, like people have been focusing on digital marketing specifically, and a lot of those like tactics are no longer that effective because of what we're saying, like it's easier to automate that stuff. So like you need to do like more human. And in general, you are saying about doing things more like one-to-one human, mm-hmm. or like what's your...
Or one to a few, like instead of sending a campaign to 100,000 people, we could say send 100 campaigns that are unique to 1,000 people each or 100 people each. It doesn't necessarily have to be a one-to-one. There could be some level of replication, but smaller batches, small batch we see, you know. I don't think people know how to interact with other people as well anymore. And COVID made it worse, but it was already a problem. And the last, I'll leave you with this, kind of doom and gloom, because I need to hop in like 2 minutes. The piece of it that is my biggest struggle when navigating my business in a way through the storm, so to speak, in a way that we could grow and be useful to others. That's one of our mission statements, is we want to be relentlessly useful. Relentlessly useful. To be able to stay useful with this, how do I, as a business owner and a mentor and a leader, how do I help people learn how to interact with other humans again? Or do I embrace this new world that seems to be being formed, where their primary form of communication is texting, is messaging, is short form emojis and memes? And, you know, I've been able to maintain relationships with people on my family and friends just sending them funny little pictures. Now, when I see that person, like with my dad, he loves sending me these funny little memes and stuff on WhatsApp. When I see him again, hopefully in a couple of weeks here, if I see him again, what will that conversation look like? I've done work with him in business with him too. Like, what would the business relationship be? Do I even know how to do that anymore? I feel like we've regressed. And I don't know how to solve that problem. I've solved it for myself, but I haven't solved it well enough to be able to teach it, because I still have my training wheels on. I'm still a Padawan. So that's something that's been a recent obsession as well.
Hmm. Well, it's a great food for thought. Actually, I have a last quick one about the art. You see also about the freelancers, like the massive amounts of people coming into the market. Mm-hmm. Since I'm kind of mostly now trying to like focus on like who is my audience for, in general, whatever I'm publishing, I'm mostly thinking of people that were before me, kind of nomads, people wanting to create their own thing, start their business, maybe travel, get into this world. I'm like thinking, you know, what would be your advice, seeing that what you just said, that it, like, at the bottom, there is so much competition now, like all the platforms are flooded. Like, if someone wanted to get into the world of like remote work or online business, like location independent business, like, what do you have any like thoughts on, like, how principles of, like, how would that person make it easier for themselves? Stupid mistake, maybe. How would they avoid
All right, I'll go real fast. Number one, you do need to be willing to do more for less. So all this talk about don't devalue yourself is not as relevant anymore. Cash flow is still king. So having a bunch of small checks is still better than having no check. The other piece, and this is something I'm working on myself too, is if you are able to find good clients or good partners where you could do a fee plus a percentage of equity plus a percentage of profit, that structure I think is going to become more popular. All right. It's already popular in other industries that I work in. I think it's going to get more popular in the digital marketing, like, freelance community. Three, communities. It's worth $10 a month. It's worth $100 a month to pay to get in these communities. Pay for it.
Mm.
Pay to get in there, interact, watch. And I think that learning how to navigate these communities in a way that's not douchey and not salesy and useful will result in money. And that's something, that's how I started my business, was in a Rocket Themes forum. I just offer to teach people how to do things. And right now I think we're kind of cyclically coming back to that. And, like, that's why I'm excited about you sharing with building community, because done correctly, it could be good for everybody.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of the Quest for Questions podcast. If your immediate reaction after listening to this episode is either, fuck, that's some great advice, can't wait for more, where do I sign up? Or, man, I had the same idea in mind, but I assumed it's just me being weird. Thank you for sharing. Or, this bastard hurt my feelings, offended my delicate soul, and should be banned from the internet. Then it means we're on the right track, doing God's work. In that case, make sure to subscribe, review, or do whatever else is allowed by technology to support this show. If you want to suggest a quest or have a question worthy of a quest, head to conradyerba.com. Go down the rabbit hole of truth each and every Sunday. Available on most podcasting platforms, YouTube, and Pirate Bay. Wink, wink. Let Yerba be with you.